This is Paul Nixon from Corporate Eye, playing roving reporter yet again. And today I'm with Stuart Bartram. And Stuart's had a great history in the digital side, having spent 20 years at Aviva, and just finished there. And we're going to talk about a whole range of things, from what makes a great site, the impact of social media, and launching brand programs. So, Stuart, do you want to start off by talking a bit about your background and how you've seen things evolve?
Yeah, hello, everyone. It's been quite an interesting journey, I guess. And some of the things that I learnt when I first entered the big world of work a number of years ago still hold true today for me, I think. And that's because I began my career as a junior reporter, apprentice reporter, and learnt my craft, you know, getting fully qualified, becoming a senior reporter, and then getting more into the design end of things around laying out pages, pagination around publications and stuff like that. And that's really when I began to understand around about targeting content for specific audiences. And one of those great lessons then was, you know, where I worked, I was running, or helping to run in a fleet of weekly newspapers, having worked and done a lot on the dailies. And the weeklies were these ones that kind of once a week, you know, came out in a market town somewhere, quite a sizable population, and kind of summed up what was going on in that week. And within it, you would have, you know, your news pages, your sports pages, your arts pages, your what's on going on. And thinking about building content every week on that schedule for that was one of those lessons that sticks with me today.
Good discipline.
And it begins now, and also, it's, you know, a newspaper thing is not only about reporting in those days in terms of straight factual thing, it's often about storytelling and enabling quite complex issues to be get across in quite simple ways, you know, so the greater majority of people can read and understand them. And that is a lesson that still holds true today for content. You know, the art of simplicity is often one of the most difficult things to do. So I spent around about 10 years doing that, got itchy feet. And this is really when you started to see the beginning of the digital kind of emancipation, really, you know, for big companies. So we started in the newspaper group I was with. We started to do, you know, onboard editing through an Olivetti package that was in there for newspaper groups at then, where we were doing much more, you know, quite robust industrial-sized text editing, you know, shared baskets, sub-editors working, filing things in and out. Mm. But what lacked there at that stage was the ability to take that into, you know, digital page makeup. And I knew desktop publishing was just the next step for that, and that's the thing that got me really, really excited. And I knew that would be a big investment for the newspaper group I was with, and I thought I better get my act together here, because I think this is really going to change things quite dramatically. And so I started to look around, and as the dint of many of these things, it's sometimes, you know, when you start to look, you understand the people that you know and the kind of contacts and networks you have can be quite useful. And so I kind of ended up at the Norwich Union then, who said to me, we are about to digitise our staff comms in a big way. We're looking for someone who can help us with that, who will give loads of training on Adobe PageMaker. And that's where it started. So I went in to do that around staff monthly newspapers, tabloids, magazines, specific publications for the IFA channel, for the general insurance channel, for the appointed reps channel. We were talking about a lot of print, you know, going out the door, both for the staff base and to the business partners and customers. And then, so as normal, and we got to the late 90s, we began to understand what was a fledgling intranet within the Norwich Union Group, which was called Union Square, which was really a piece of thing that collected data, really, and repository for search, like, you know, hotels, approved hotels where you could stay. And the team I worked in then really started to think about how we could turn that into a news-carrying, information-carrying service that would unite any staff, wherever they were, worked in the company. And so we persuaded the management to can the monthly staff newspaper, and we launched our new kind of intranet in Norwich Union called The Pulse in about late 98. And it had a daily news service on it, and we were producing that regularly to keep staff updated of not only NU matters, but industry news, regulatory news, anything that we felt was of interest to staff working in that. And also we were delivering more feature-based stuff once a week in a kind of digital magazine thing that we were building. I remember the nights as every approach every week, you know, in Microsoft Front Page, building those. I'd been a Quark Express user for a long while, and remember doing all that and kind of understanding the vagaries of HTML in the beginning there of why doesn't that work when I'm doing everything I should do. And I guess what then the most significant thing we did that was that NU then in 2000 announced it was merging with CGU, which again was the product of a merger that Commercial Union and General Accident had put together in 98. It was very new. And so the new company was going to be launched on the London Stock Exchange. And I worked in a team where we looked at what would be the needs of what that company had as a .com. So we had a NorwichUnion.com and CGU had a .com. But they were very much product consumer focused with a bit of company stuff in it. And we thought that obviously the merger had been sold on a lot of number of things in terms of a lot of cost savings and merger benefits that would needed to be communicated to the city, not only in terms of the, you know, winning shareholder approval, but absolutely executing the strategy, you know, to
and
ensure
showing that you were delivering it.
Absolutely, to make sure the cost savings. And we understood that this was a thing that would probably be an editorial management process rather than a customer or marketing-led thing. So we made a bid to take over the running of the .com. And at that stage, the company had rather handily christened itself CGNU, which Richard Harvey and Bob Scott, joint CEOs, said took them less than 20 minutes to agree. And you understand why 2 years later, because there was always a longer strategy to rebrand the PLC company and some of the overseas territories, which has culminated in recent years with Norwich Union in the UK, Hibernian in Ireland, and CU in Poland, coming over to the full Aviva, you know, single branding name. So it's 2002, Aviva launched. So within that time, we launched cgnugroup.com, and within about a year and a half, we launched in July 2002, the first Aviva.com. And subsequently, over the last 8 to 9 years, we've had a number of relaunches. One of those was absolutely, I remember it very well, on September the 30th, 2004, the day before the obligations under the Disability Discrimination Act came in for many companies. And we wanted to, as a company, take that very seriously. CSR at that stage was becoming a very important thing in Aviva, in our DNA and the way we do things around here, and it seemed absolutely right that our corporate web presence should, you know, pay attention to accessibility issues for visually impaired and physically impaired users. And that was an absolutely salutary experience for me, because at that time there was a lot of, you know, hyperbole about actually what this would do, but actually what that fundamentally did was made you look at the way you communicated, and what was effectively simpler, and I'm absolutely convinced to this day you ended up with better websites by going through that process for everyone, not just those pockets of users. And then we relaunched the site again in 2007, and I've always been considered that, you know, part of our thing is to actually keep this digital pace and agenda moving within the company and helping them understand. And part of those things that we started in 2004 was start to bring those Aviva branded businesses under a uniform kind of online identity. So we issued our first set of guidelines in 2004, refreshed them when we did them in 2007. And then when NU moved over to Aviva in June 2009, we had another refresh and a relaunch of the site there with a fresh set of guidelines, which are now being adopted by our many of our major public customer-facing websites in the 28 countries around the world. So that's where we were. Along the way, we had lots of highs, one or two lows, but generally a pretty aggressive, progressive agenda, really, to take us from a site that at the start had 40,000 visits a month to, you know, as in the months I left, just before I left at the end of March, you know, we were well over 250,000.
Wow.
A month. Mm-hmm. And I think the most significant change in that, Paul, for me, is we started with a site, and I guess we're going to go on to talk about this, which was a niche product for PLC stakeholders. And what we have now is the company's biggest storytelling machine that they have. We don't have corporate brochures. We have a report and accounts, which, you know, fulfills a purpose. But the biggest place for people to find out about us and increasingly to interact and engage with us is through our .com on a global basis, and there and its equivalents as a customer-facing thing in each country. So the majority audience now, which is quickly growing, is not your shareholders or your analysts or your fund managers or your city journalists. It's everyday customers who come into contact with Aviva and want to know more about us.
And, you know, where... I mean, if you look around all the different corporate sites now, and there has been obviously a huge evolution from 2000 all the way up to now, what do you think characterises the best sites? What are the things that, when you look at, you think, yes, they've really got it right?
I think the thing that... I often make these judgments with a professional eye, but not trying to forget about the way that I simply react when I engage with, whether it's I'm trying to buy something online, or I'm trying to take part in a community, or I'm trying to find out information, you know, to make a, whether it's a purchasing decision or investment decision, these kind of things that I just do, forget what job I do, how do I react as a human? And I think there's definitely stages of the way that people go through that. So you could say that, you know, there'd be a school of thought that says almost like thoroughness. Everything's there that you could want it. But then you go, well, that's great and very worthy, but is it easily findable, searchable, updatable, accurate, and useful? So then I think there's this big pull through... the recent years, which is as we've seen a you know, global economy shaken to its core in many respects by the you know, the trust issue around big companies, and pretty dominated by trust issues around financial services, you know, in terms of the American crisis and the UK here, and pretty much mirrored everywhere in the world. And you know, within that, what's the role of insurance companies within that? So I think there's been a huge drive as people began to understand that, you know. And a long way to go if you read the Edelman Trust Barometer, you know, published a couple of months ago, about how ordinary people still view, you know, banks and insurance companies compared to governments and all other kind of organisations or institutions that they trust. But I think big financial services companies have understood that transparency is probably one of those things that can help them in this. So it's about, as I often call it in... when I was talking about release of content into the wild, you know, content that companies know they have, but don't publish externally, but will share internally, and actually having the courage and reassurance to actually say, we can publish it and make it findable and talk about it. So one of the simple things that we did years ago was actually make all our companies' house regulatory returns available on the web in PDF. Because that, you know, Companies House would give them to anyone who wanted them if they could make that, and it was just about saying to people, no, we, you know, they're here and we will provide them, and we'll tell you, you know, every year they'll be published at this date. If you want to read a 128-page, you know, thing on this, here it is. And obviously, there is a certain amount of cost saving that's done that, because the old way of doing that was to have very, you know, heavily managed printed bound copies that would then be posted out to analysts everywhere like this. And so that began to trigger things. And, you know, at Aviva, we were on a journey to do some of that. We relaunched our investor centre in 2008. And one of the things we did like that was to take that transparency message further about why we felt people should invest with Aviva. And the other side of it is why they should stay investors with Aviva, you know, when there would be all these kind of contributing factors that might make them worry. And I think that was trying to, in some respects, you know, from a very financial, corporate, financial reporting dimension, lift the bonnet on the company and try and make people understand what it is operationally we do and why we believe we're successful and how that then translates into, you know, capital and financial return for investors and ensures a bright future for everyone involved. So we did that, and I think, but I think the biggest shift, undoubtedly, as we do all this, and trust is a very big thing, and I think it is connected with the growth of community-based, you know, social media, collectives, whatever you want to call it, the where technology has enabled so much so easily, very quickly, you know, the last great big recession was the birth of invention, I guess, if you could say, you know, in the, at that time that Aviva CGNU was coming together, and this big thing about the first dot-com bust, you know, and then this kind of growth of these amazing kind of businesses that we still see around today, eBay, you know, Amazon, Google. And people beginning to look at them and thinking how technology had enabled a different kind of business model there, you know, very different, and that perhaps people could do their own version of it for different things. And I think in the last 2 years, you know, there was all that excuse where you saw it with MySpace and Bebo particularly, that people almost were waiting, and then because MySpace, you know, the great acquisition by News International, was it $350 million or pounds, lots of money, whatever way you look at it, Bebo, similarly by AOL. And then, of course, they did kind of start to begin to wane, and people were going, oh, social media, it's this new kind of fad. So yesterday. So that's not, what's the next big thing? What's Web 2, Web 3 and all that? But then began, people, I think, really began to understand that out of that, there came these beasts that we now know, you know, Facebook, YouTube.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, there are, people can get very het up with, you know, next generation, Web 2, Web 3, and so on. And yet, I still think that of the fundamental things that they need to still sort out are still at the storytelling level. And so many companies actually, I think there is a huge gulf between what they currently, most people currently do, and where they could be in terms of, as you say, explaining what the company currently does, pulling together the strategy in a coherent place, in a coherent way, so that instead of just having little pockets, if indeed they do have the different parts of content around the site, actually bringing it together and telling that story.
I think you're absolutely right, because at the end of the day, the technology is just the enabler, you know, and you can make it easier, but actually it's like, what's the story you want to tell, and is it interesting enough? And I think, you know, in parallel, I think this is why the growth of corporate blogging is really connected with this, because it's easy, the technology is relatively easy, but it's about, what you, are you just going to replicate what people can find elsewhere? So we're going to put the news releases through it, you know, and we've all been, and you know, guilty of that. We, you know, our Twitter feed on Aviva, which we set up in January last year, is now just, it just went through its 1,000th, you know, subscriber, and a lot of that is driven by just making accessible information that we carry through news release or RSS elsewhere. And we're beginning that, you know, this year we began that thing about exploring about how we can turn it from broadcast to dialogue, you know, traditional social media thing. But I think this is really about corporate blogging, because it's actually, what would you put in it that people would find interesting that they couldn't get elsewhere, and it's worth reading, you know?
Yeah, it's got to be worth reading.
And so then when you're in a company, it's about, you know, let alone, let's not forget this, you know, even though the tools make it easy, it's still resource time, thinking time, and it's not just, you know, it's got to be done
regularly.
And, you know, the fact that you've got to build an audience, and it might take a little time, you're not, it's not going to be success overnight. But fundamentally, I think it's why big companies struggle with this, is that they struggle to think what they would say that's not outside their normal communication channels through news releases or statements and stuff like that, or who they would trust to talk about that. So, you know, if you have a CEO who just says, I really want to do it, and as we've seen a number of these, and, you know, you kind of go, great, and then you kind of go, but what's the, you know, it's traditional communication things, back to that newspaper planning. So what have we got the issue this week that's going to make people want to buy this? And then what are we going to have next week that's going to want to make them buy it again? And I think that kind of content strategy is one of the big things that's now coming out for corporate websites, both in terms of destination, your .com, but also how you distribute your content. And actually, I think, and you know, I think one of the things that I would have been tackling at Aviva this year is with Aviva.com, even though we've got to a nice space, and I would have thought there was pieces that we could still do where we were weak. But fundamentally, we've got a big site. And I think this is the thing that's falling on a lot of people now, is actually a content strategy that helps elevate, not so much that you have to lose a lot of content, because in some respects, corporate websites, that's their job, archival, resource, the ability in an industry like insurance, where these analysts love writing 10-year trend reports, and I like to go and be able to find what we said, you know, in 2002 and all that business, and we can serve a great purpose and gain kudos and reputation for that by making it easy and findable and easy extractable from the site.
Yep.
But I think it's hoping a lot for some of these regular users to kind of, you know, alert them to, this is new over here. It's a little bit, could be, you know, you could argue it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. So I think
also what's most popular, or
absolutely,
most downloaded.
So that social media device that, you know, yeah, see on many things is, you know, most popular, most shared, most emailed, that kind of thing. I think you'll see more of that in terms of helping users to try to find stuff that people like them are also finding interesting. I think that's also, and we ran with some of this on Aviva, the ability to customise and personalise certain pages. Mm. So if you're in the investor centre and you were a retail shareholder and you really didn't want the hardcore institutional stuff, you could make the page work for you. And I think that's, I guess the jury would still be out on whether how useful that is.
I was going to say, honestly, did you get much reaction?
Yeah, we got enough, but it didn't take off in massive numbers. But you can. I've always thought about this and saying, you know, corporate websites, we're not like a million visits a month. You know, some might be or whatever. Mm. But within those audience groups, is actually, if the people are using it, it's not so much the numbers, but actually who's in that group. The influencers in that who kind of go, no, I really don't take that away. I really find this useful, and I talk positively about this when I talk to other people. And that's why I like you as a company, because I think you do this really well. And so you kind of think about those powerful influencers in terms of, you know, perhaps low thousands of users rather than tens of thousands of users. And you think, well, actually, we've met their need, which is important, you know, in a kind of trying to be everything for everyone. There are key people that we still need to think about regularly.
But I think there's another point which people forget, which is that it's being seen to be doing something, which then has an influence on people's perceptions. So that if you are seen to provide, as you were saying before, every possible answer that someone might want to ask, then even though I don't read every single answer, I'm grateful that you've done it.
Yeah.
And I'm getting a perception that you are open and transparent and helpful and wanting to answer, and customer-oriented, so wanting to answer my questions. And therefore, you know, even though I might not count in that number of people who go to and use the custom service, I certainly will take a positive message from it.
I think that's true, and I think this is where this content strategy and storytelling becomes really, really important, because elevating content of trying to help people, to help them understand, you know, what you think is important to you to tell them about. I also think we've seen this shift, you know, it's connected with what I said earlier about just the people. Years ago, you know, you'd ask the, you know, a key set of analysts or the professional investment community, you know, what do you think of the report and accounts? Hmm. And they go, I love all those tables. Yeah. Well, I'd never look at them. Don't read the review, don't read all that rubbish, you know, all that communications marketing stuff at the front. You might as well just send me all those tables in a Word document. I think in my experience in the last 10 years, you've seen a shift. Now, I don't know whether it's generational or whatever, but you see a new breed of people who come and actually, and I think this is fundamentally, for me, this is how, going back to how I respond, is actually, so I'm interested in those numbers and how they get made in terms of profit and loss and, you know, new business and activity within the business. But actually, what I'm really interested in is, surely that's the heart of that is, how do you run your business to make it a meaningful one for customers to buy from you, stay longer, and buy more? So that's when you need to really lift the bonnet on your operational stuff around activity in the business, new initiatives, the way you're trying to improve your service, your admin, the way you are coming up with customer-based initiatives to really connect for that, that will produce greater profits and benefit for all around. And I think there's a new generation of, and I remember once when we did one of these R&A surveys, you know, there was one young guy who just said to me in this rather, or said to the questioners in the group, in a rather plaintive voice about this, you know, the marketing communications aspect of the report and accounts and the branding and the identity, he said to me, or said to the group, you know, don't forget I'm human too. You know, I do look at things like that, because I'm beginning to look at the way you communicate in that, what you're saying, let alone just a kind of dedicated focus on numbers. I'm looking at that to help form judgments about you. And in similar way, when we before we relaunched Aviva.com in 2009, we did some user experience studio stuff with a company in a lab. And we had a fund manager came in, and it kind of, he was asked, you know, how do you use corporate websites? And it kind of, you know, it's one of those things, you're sitting on the other side of the glass like the CID, looking at it all, and you're going, oh, no, this is not going to stop. Because immediately he said, oh, I never use them. I don't use them much, and you go like that. But then he said the Holy Grail, which is, but I absolutely insist all my team use them in their research decisions. So he said, my team, that's their job. I used to do it, but, we pore over sites like this and like these because that's where the information is, and we make judgments about how successful it is and whether we can get the information and things like that, which give us a barometer on what we think how healthy the company is and the way the focus is on this in terms of a communication device. So that was kind of like almost burying my head in my hand thinking, oh my God. that was the kind of thing of saying that, no, it's an absolutely essential to what we do in terms of judging companies. And I think increasingly, rather than dry kind of reporting, I think these people are more receptive to storytelling that actually conveys a similar message of actually why this produces a certain profit line or whatever. And they increasingly, I guess the other thing is, don't just want to read it. They want to be, I'm not sure if it's entertained, but they're more receptive to using the web and sites and technology in a way, almost like TV on their desktop, laptop. So film, audio is going to be, and it's already arrived in a minute. I think that's going to be, that's what the web is there for, not just copy and paste, written word, which we've all done. And in some respects, many of us, I guess, have done, and I'll hold our hand up at Aviva. We do it. You copy and paste it out of a thing that's purpose for somewhere else, and because you need to get it done, you don't really rewrite it for the web. And I think that's the next big thing around the content strategy, about repurposing that content for the medium it's really intentioned for. But I think a lot of that is going to be overtaken now by the different ways of communicating, where increasingly people are saying, give me 500 words or a minute of film. What am I going to pick?
Oh,
500 words, I might not even get through 200 before my attention has been drawn elsewhere. A minute, and you might have a chance, particularly if you can do it well and you can give me three succinct, clear messages I can remember out of that.
That you do it well is key, though.
Yeah.
And this is where it's very easy for people to just assume, make a video, it'll all be great. If you get the right person doing it, if you look at the CEO videos on GSK,
yeah,
Andrew Witty, inspirational,
yeah,
shows thought leadership, the direction he is taking the company, and it's great from all different sort of angles, whether from a job hunter or a CSR analyst or an investor, it is uplifting,
yeah,
and it changes the nature of your interaction with the site. But if you have a bad video, then you can turn people off. And I guess the key thing is to know the difference and not just assume that just because you have filmed a senior executive saying something, that you've got a tick in the box.
And I think that's, I think that for two things, that goes back to what we were talking about around content strategy. What do you want to say and how successful are you going to do it? Are you just going to be like, it's great, isn't it? This free-form blogging, flip video stuff. We can just do it in the audience. Do it in the office. It looks really authentic, doesn't it? I've watched a number of those where that kind of, you think, yeah, there is an authenticity, homespun, connective quality about that, where I do think, yeah, they haven't spent fortune. That's the guy. I know he's the CEO. But I'm kind of going, it's not been thought out what the scripting of what he's saying here. And like the 500 words, after 23 seconds, I'm hitting the stop or pause button. And that's the other great thing, or difficulty in web video on the web, is that if you do these head-to-head things, you invite people, you don't really need to look often at what they're saying, as opposed to listen. And you invite people to scour around content around the page that is sat on often, and suddenly they're going and their mind is wandering and they've gone, this is not really holding my attention, and then they go, oh, what's this over here? And away they go. And I mean that kind of diversion, you know, the distractive quality of the web, that thing. We've all done it where we've gone out to search for something in Google and end up somewhere else and go, how did I get here? Because we get taken down these paths, you know, in terms of, particularly if you've got a curious nature, you kind of find yourself going down them sometimes. And I think it's really, really true. And so, but that's not to say, you know, and it's quite interesting with Cisco killing the flip, you know, in terms of one of these things that really heralded this in. And but obviously now you can see, because you can buy major SLRs now from Canon, Nikon, you know, that do your stills and then we'll do a nice bit of quality HD video as well, the old bundled in. That's the way of the world. But with flip, you know, it's actually high quality stuff. You could do it. It is really cheap. But fundamentally, you need to light it properly and you need to think about what you're saying in it, because it won't, the technology won't make it meaningful.
It's the boys, not the toys.
Absolutely.
So let's sort of standing back around some of those things we've talked about. Who have the websites that you, apart from obviously the good of either one, have the websites that you respect and why?
I spent 20 years in an insurance company, and someone asked me about this morning, actually, and my answer to that was, I was always an absolute voracious soaker up of other people's stuff. And I never, whilst, you know, you work in, and I guess, you know, people listening to this might understand this, that you have this thing about your peer group in terms of the industry you're in, and that's really important, and that's important for you internally. To kind of understand that you might be doing things a little better than your competitors, and you hope that's a sign, and that actually you're in business, you know, to try and eat each other's lunch. But fundamentally, what has driven me is not too much focus in that. It has largely been on looking at what's happening in the bigger, wider world. So what are telecoms companies doing? What are energy companies doing? What are big retail businesses doing that have this kind of, probably, you know, understanding closer connection with them, the people that come and use their services day in, day out, you know. And then it's not just about jolly old what's happening here in England, the UK. It's about that Europe and seeing the growth and understanding of what's happening in the States and the Far East. It's truly a global business. And the beauty is, you know, when I sit at home, and, you know, I live in Norfolk and I sit in my house in a little village just south of Norwich, I have the world at my fingertips. Or even when I sit on the train to London now with the Wi-Fi connection through, you know, my iPad, I can actually spend quality time reviewing these things. So that really fires me up and energises me. So the thing that I like to look at, big company. So GSK, you mentioned, I have a lot of time for what they're doing, particularly this storytelling element that, you know, I've heard Simon Quayle at GSK talk about there. In terms of that, that's definitely reflected in that the style of those CEO interviews. I like just the relentless march that Siemens, you know, just does things, gets things done. With Florian and the team there, they just, you know, they're kind of brave. They're down the further down the road because they've been at it longer. They, you know, they're a big company, 400,000 staff around the world. They've had their hiccups of reputational issues along the way to deal with.
But they really address them.
Absolutely.
And you know, they are, if you like, the example that I hold up for how to show believably that you have taken on ethics and put it in your, embedded it in your culture. Not just a, you know, here's our code of ethics, which is, you know, I always beat on about not being the latest best practices.
And then General Electric, you know, because you there's a point where you just kind of go, because companies are bigger, have been at it longer, and they've had more money to spend, and so have got to things before you. You might have had the ideas, and I guess a lot of other people sitting here will say, you know, we're not short of ideas. What we might be is absolutely the ability to have budget and resource to do them all at once. And I've often said that if you had that, you know, what would you do next? You know, it kind of like, and part of the beauty of the web is this organic growth and this kind of the fact that if you introduce new stuff, it implies that you're paying attention to what you're doing, and there's stuff that makes people want to come back and discover new things to read or view. So I like that. But then I get into things about within segments, you know. So who does investor really well, but the overall site perhaps is not so good. So who's really, really strong on careers and recruitment? And I like some of the stuff that Coca-Cola do on the recruitment. I like particularly in their Europe stuff. I like the way that Coke particularly have started to pay a lot of attention to their heritage and history.
Mm-hmm.
Around, you know, this secret recipe and the blog, one that, you know, and the archivists there, I think that, and that's particularly why, because Aviva is a company with 300 years of history, and we, you know, a few years ago, we took our museum online virtually, you know, so that people could search loads of things, and we've seen the growth of that incredibly. We've developed a number of things in that interactive sort of timeline involving video, digitizing these wonderful assets that we had stuck away on shelves and opening them up. And we've done other things that I hope people found interesting around the difficult subject, but around the both world wars and the service and that people gave then, you know, in terms of the conscription, the loss of life, and the impact on some, you know, one in three men in an office getting killed, you know. And just acknowledging under our recognition brand promise about that these people did a thing like that. And it was a storytelling thing to help, you know, people remember. And it's not many years ago, within the last century, that people were confronted with this in their everyday lives. So I like that. But the thing that I talked about this morning, which really said to me, was actually you can look around that and it's a kind of like, well, they would do that, wouldn't they? Because they're huge and they've got all this money. What I used to love doing more than anything... It's like, and we were lucky enough in some years to be, you know, in the IR Society Best Practice Awards or, you know, IFS the Shareholder Awards or a number of these awards and, you know, do well enough and win them sometimes. I used to love looking at the shortlist, but I used to really love looking at the shortlist and the entries in the FTSE 250 because I think major companies get stricken sometimes by this legacy. They've been around a long time, so certain things are slower to do. And they are hamstrung by, this is the way we do it around here. And then there's this, to connect all that up, well, we've got this legacy database. And it kind of, it's difficult for a lot of big companies. When you look at these new companies, all these new ones, they're not often hamstrung by this. Mm. And so they have a different thing about actually, well, we don't have that to deal with, so the world's our oyster. So I was really fascinated by the way they would tackle similar things, the agility and flexibility they've shown, the way they would tackle it. And you kind of go around and unashamedly look at it and say, oh, look how they've done that, or they've done that. I want, you know, that probably didn't cost a heap of money, but what a neat way of doing it, you know.
Mm.
And so I used to love looking at all those because I think in those companies, in some respects, are the ones that eventually want to join up with the big boys in 5-10 years time. They will hopefully enter the FTSE 100 there. That's probably their business strategy, and they will be having all those obligations of listed companies even more tenfold. And so I thought there was a real rich picking for learning, education, knowledge, just driving my curiosity in those. And of course, I guess the other thing is actually the absolute... So when you understand it, why has Facebook... Why is Friends Reunited not Facebook? You know, Friends Reunited started as a way of people coming together, largely through an educational thing. So why didn't that become Facebook and be where Facebook is today? It's largely because the technology and the connected qualities, you know, just... And then... You kind of say, so look at the way they use simplicity here and the way they connect and feed or provide ability to this connective thing. And I think you see that about in the younger generation. And I think anyone who's a parent, you know, I used to have a lot of freedom when I was young. And my parents would let me go out here, there and everywhere. And it's kind of like, you know, just make sure, you know, someone, just be, make sure you're back by dusk. And you'd always push it, wouldn't you? And I guess it's a product of... the way we live now is that as parents and like that, we just get a little bit more scared. There's more cars on the road. There's not so many open spaces. There's not many things to do. It all seems a bit more of a difficult world. But it still doesn't drive away the need for these youngsters, you know, in their teenage years. They want to be together. They want to do the things that I was doing, like hang around, you know, hang around the paper shop and go over the rack and play some football, then hang around the paper shop and that kind of thing, just because you want to be with your mates. And so what they're coming home and saying, no, we don't want you out doing this. And so actually they're finding this way to connect, you know, whether it's through Bebo or, you know, or the migration that seems largely to happen now into Facebook or MSN Messenger. And I think that's really, really interesting because they want to be together to share experiences, talk about the films, what you're doing, you know, when we're going shopping, all these kind of things that used to take place in a very verbal conversation when you met up with your mates. And they are driving this incredibly, I think. And the technology that Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and a number of their ilk have really, you know, it just makes it so easy. You know, I mentioned to you earlier, Paul, you know, for someone like me who's a corporate communicator, digital communicator, you know, you do the lessons with my eldest who's 13, and you talk about responsibility, you know, surfing the web, and she comes to you and says, can I have an MSN account? And you do all that, and you kind of control it, and you have all your family things. Then the next thing is, can I have a Facebook account? You know, and she started on Bebo. Very interesting for me. Not very long on there, straight into Facebook, peer pressure like that. Understood it, you know, kind of like this, and then, you know.
Came and asked, that was good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, yeah, having access, but then you realise that actually, when I started to look actually who she was talking to, it's the circle of friends. And it might be bigger because it's the way it happened than my, you know, little gang that I ran around with, but actually, it's largely the people that she's at school with or knows like that. It's not many people she don't know on there, you know. And then you discover that she's also got a Twitter account and she's beginning to use it to connect with her friends, and she's been able to do that. She's not come to me for that and say, no, you know, this would be a good thing. And I'm kind of thinking, she's 13, she's quite mature and responsible so far, and she's learning this. So as a digital communicator, I'm understanding, I'm preaching, you know, the impact this is having on the world. So I you know, if she'd have said, I don't know, what do you want to use that for? You know, you can wait till you're 18 and responsible. But she's done it, and she's learned it from her peers. All established, got a nice background on there, you know, profile pic, and you know. So when I discovered it, it's kind of like, you know, good for you. But it's absolutely salutary about how easy it is for these people to connect and like that. And that drives me into one of my hobby horses, absolutely, which is, I think, for corporate communications or any kind of communications that's trying to connect with people, it's fixing the here and now is, yeah, busy. We all do it. And it's relatively one of the simple things, you know, planning what you're going to do in 3-6 months, you know, next year. The real big ticket thing is actually planning about 3, 5, 7, 9 years' time. Because my daughter, if she goes into further education, by the time her and her ilk come out into the big wide world of ugly work in their early 20s, say, they are going to be bringing a technological driven level of expectation that's unbelievable. So they're going to be saying, I want to be a customer of yours and I do things like this, so what have you got? How can I do it? Or I want to be part of a community.
Show me.
I want to be part of a community, so I'm interested in these things, so how do I, you know, like that. Or I am going to be working for you, so what kind of tools have you got that can help me do my job for you better? Or finally, I'd like to be an investor, you know, I think I might want to be a shareholder or a stakeholder or something within that. So how do I don't want to turn up physically. I don't ever want to work in your office, but I want to be part of your business and have a connection with you. So what have you got? Oh, you haven't got that. Well, perhaps I'll go over there because they seem to have got it and that fits with me, that. And I think every business should be thinking about this change that's happening. You're seeing it happen every moment. And the fact that big business, which is predominantly, say, supermarket business, who used to rely on people, you know, once, 2-3 times a week, whatever it was, physically, you know, going to these big out, you know, small shops and big out-of-town stores, accommodating, we must have huge car parks because they're all coming in their droves. This growth of their internet business, you know, fascinating, because people at the end of the day, in great numbers, say, don't actually physically need to do that. I buy the same thing nearly every week. Why don't I just make it easy for myself, give me more free time and have it delivered? And I think, yeah, big companies have really got to seriously think about not only what these implied changes are and things that we know around the internet in your hand through mobile technology, the community aspects of connecting and also, you know, delivering verdicts on companies through, you know, either praise or damning when things go wrong. But how, you know, what is the world going to look like? And it's not actually these great things like futurologists, but these things are now happening at quite a pace. And there's things that you think, oh, they'll never take off, and do. There's things that you kind of go, oh, that looks really, really good, and it doesn't. So predicting the future is a difficult art, but there's certain themes that come together. And, you know, particularly when you look at a global position, you see certain themes emerging. The much, you know, spoken about rise of mobile technology in the Asia-Pacific. The fact that already, I think, you know, if we stop today and look at the number of TVs in the world,
mm-hmm.
the number of desktop computers, and then absolutely dwarfed by the number of mobile phones, and then within that segment, the absolutely accelerating rise of smartphones within that. So if you are a increasing westernized person in China, what's the likelihood you will buy a desktop computer to put in the corner of wherever you live? It might be in a rural situation. Who knows? How likely are you to buy a web-enabled phone in the next 10 years? Quite likely. And how, therefore, are you expecting to do your connections with whoever it is with that, with your friends and or your bank or your customers or your supermarket or your fashion or whatever? And I think that's the thing that, you know, that drives me. Two things. Thinking about that is absolutely helping companies to understand that. And I think that has implications not only for big business global, but absolutely for you know, small to medium-sized firms as well, about their customers and the way they want to provide, fundamentally, driven, you know, a choice. Because those companies that kind of go, we're here in that way and we don't want that anymore, is a difficult balance, I know, but actually that's what this other thing is driving. The demand that people can say, I choose to do it like this, what have you got?
And if you don't?
I know I'm different to that, that last person you were talking to, but that's me. I'm, you know, that's what floats my boat. I want to do it like this. So I think that's where companies starting to need to think really about what their response and what they're going to do about that.
Because I think you do have a recognition of that, maybe not to the extent of how big it's going to be or how far some of these transitions will happen, but it's a kind of tomorrow problem for them, and they see it scary. It's more, I think, wanting to know how to get started. You know, how do you get, you know, where you've got the majority of people who haven't, of corporate communicators who have not started to properly engage in social media or in interacting with their stakeholders in various ways. How long ago and how did you guys go about building up support and doing social media within Aviva?
I guess I've often talked about this before, and I think our introduction of understanding the technology and the functionality of the social media, and, you know, the beginning of Web 2, we were very, very fortunate, I think. We had the opportunity to support around the world saver called Dee Kafari. For those of you listening to Radio 2 on Monday, back on Dee Monday, she was on the Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders show. But she's a, now, you know, all those years later, the only woman to have sold around the world three times, front and back, you know, against prevailing winds. But we were supporting her in her first attempt. And we were working with an agency, the group. I know you've done audio interviews and that. And so what was fantastic, apart from being told, we're sponsoring this round the world yachtsman, we need a website within 6 weeks because she leaves Portsmouth and Gunwharf Quay on, you know, November.
And she ain't going to be waiting.
And it's kind of like, and it's kind of like in our normal style, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, with thanks to the group, it's kind of like, and that's the other thing I think we need, you know, you really need to, it doesn't have to be bang, bang, it's right. Well, we'll get a site ready for launch and then the full site will come on stream later. You know, phased delivery for certain things is really, really achievable, and, you know, the right road. Instead of breaking your back to get everything ready, you know, and it kind of not hanging together on mm-hmm. launch, you know, it doesn't all have to be there, certain things. So we used what was then called the Aviva Challenge as what I've often described in Aviva as our laboratory.
Mm.
So we had to build a community around Dee. She was going to be away at sea for a long, long while, on her own.
Going to need a lot of friends.
A lot of friends, and not only for her to communicate to you know, the mark the progress of our sponsorship, but also for her to get the reassurance that, you know, people were very interested in her. So we had lots of blogging tools for her, that we got technology from the boat back. We had well-wishing messages. And then when we supported her again, when she took up the second challenge, which was to enter the Vendée Globe, We turned that into a fully fledged Aviva Ocean Racing site, and the social media tilt and that just went to the nth degree again. So we had team blogs, we had audio, we had podcasts, we had, you know, sending video back from the ship, all that kind of just went to the next stage. Yep. And what that absolutely gave for us was an opportunity to actually understand how this thing works, why people find it interesting, why they engage with it, and actually what is its implications into more kind of what you'd call drier corporate communications through your.com. And so we were able to learn a lot in that and then actually gradually phase some of that stuff into the.com. The other thing I think is absolutely just being brave. I remember sitting there, and I can tell you now, and it's there, you know, the Aviva PLC YouTube channel was created in September 2006, which is quite early in some respects. Why? Because I was reading about YouTube, and I was thinking, what, they give this all for free? Wow, this is interesting. I'll just go and set up a little thing here. What have we got over here? Well, we've got some of this video content. Let's think, have we got a... No, we can just reuse it. We've got all the rights, you know. And so I set up that very first thing just to hand content out there to say, I wonder if people would just put in that search something about, I don't know, you know, Aviva or another keyword, like insurance or...
Yeah.
You know, let's just see what it means. And of course, we then, with Dee, we built a YouTube channel for her because we felt this has got to be people. There must be thousands of people around whom will type in sailing or adventure or yachting, you know, because they like, that's their thing, as opposed to football or cricket or Justin Bieber. So we just did that, and we learned so much in that. And you see a lot of what you see in Aviva.com today comes from that. And we were very lucky that we were able to do it in that sponsorship site as a laboratory for us. But it gave us the courage, it gave us the understanding of how these things work and how our roles and responsibilities in it as well in terms of managing communities. And
you have specific community managers then from...
Well, no, what we used to do it ourselves, you know, really, and with the help of a group like that in terms of, you know, this thing about comments and blog comments, you know, people go, oh, that's really good, but big companies go, well, who's approving them then? You know, who's checking they're okay? Because the technology makes it very easy for you to do that, but you have to do it regularly because people get quite frustrated, you know, if they comment on, then it doesn't appear, you know, for a little while, and we didn't always get it right, and there was delays, but you began to understand. And when you get these people who, you know, coming in and you understood and you look at your metrics and this traffic that's building up and these messages coming from all around the world, people wishing Dee well, from landlocked countries, you know, the head of the Turkish Navy, the First Lord of the Admiralty and coming in. But it was more close about these home ones. This lady here, I remember once, had said, and it was such a, you know, in the Southern Ocean, there's these icebergs and it's treacherous, you know, not allowed any human contact, you know, null and void. You can't take anything off or on, just on your own. And at one point, Dee was in the Southern Ocean and the closest human contact was actually upwards. It was the cosmonauts and the space station. So when you see these comments of someone saying, the first thing me and my daughters do every morning is basically, you know, come to your website and see if you're still alive. And then, you know, how brave you are. And you begin to understand this sense of connection and shared stuff around it and how important it is not only for Dee to understand that these people rooting for her, but how people get, you know, quite passionate about these causes or...
And far more personal.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that Dee could then respond to that and, you know, name-check a few people and meant a lot for her, you know, very emotional, fatigued, tired, you know, this kind of thing, the thing that would sustain her, that it was mattering. You know, it mattered to a number of people.
We just have to get company secretaries to think the same way about their governance.
Well, I think that I think there is a shift there because I think they're beginning to understand. So, a company like Aviva, you know, its retail shareholder list is, you know, not the biggest in the UK, but it's sizable. It's, you know, between 500,000 and 600,000. You know, they own a limited amount of the company, but they're full of people who got free shares out of the Norwich Union flotation in 97, be lots of interesting ex-people, you know, senior people at Aviva. It's a real mixed bag. And actually, they're just like everyone else, aren't they? You know, in some respects, they're like a bunch of customers or everyday people. So why wouldn't they want to take advantage of some tools around that, connected? In the same way, it's just absolutely mirrors that thing about you know, we used to send everything to you in the post, and you'd have to elect this, fill in that, send it back like that. Then, you know, companies were able to actually say, what would you rather? You know, do you want to have email, or do you want to have, you know, online growth of online reports? And then the Communications Act, you know, understood this behavioural change and enabled companies to actually default, to actually say, we're no longer going to do it like that, because a number of you have indicated this, plus it costs a lot of money, which is great for the environment, and actually it's more efficient like this. We'll still do it. This is the choice thing. If you tell us that you'd like us to, you can still have a hard copy of the report and cards, whatever. But understanding that, and I think companies beginning to... So then you kind of go, well, do we just talk to them once a year then, or do we try to build a community around their investment, their news from that, you know, not only on the site itself, so when they want to know about dividend, frequent questions, how they trade shares, all that kind of stuff. And you see suddenly all this stuff that used to be like in the shareholder's handbook move online. And I think that's probably one of the next things for retail shareholders. And you could argue that, I think, you know, would they really engage in this on a frequent enough basis? I think, you know, there's debate to be had there. But I think what they love to do is when it matters. So when they want to read about the financial reporting of the year, the success of the business, when they want to engage in the AGM, their meeting of the year. And that's why I was always... We were a huge webcaster of our investor presentations right from the word go. And I spent a lot of time really advocating the webcasting of the AGM. Because I felt, in terms of the numbers we would get across the year, you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to work it out. It would be bigger than the actual number who physically attended on the day. Yep. And so there's increasing, you know, even institutional, you know, shareholders somewhere else who probably go, I'm not coming to the Barbican to come to the AGM. But if you show me a recording of it, I'll probably watch that. Yeah. And so we were doing, yeah, not live, and only the business of the meeting, you know, not the Q&A. And I think that's a transparency thing that many companies are thinking about, where could we get big and bold enough to do that? And I think that really just starts to open up. So if you drive them on and says, oh, we're no longer sending you all this stuff in the post that you used to love, I think you've really got to start to have content on them that says, well, why should I bother coming to your website then? Well, because you can do this, you can do e-coms, you can do all this, you can see the chairman. We've got video messages, or they've even got video messages from the chairman. You see the webcast every year, you can look through that. There's all the other investor stuff that's coming in, increasing senior management interviews, not quite in the GSK scale yet in terms of regular CEO interviews, but yeah, more fixed around, you know, landmark results updates or investor presentations. And I think retail shareholders are one of the, you know, the areas that companies can, you know, really mine, and yeah, I think they would like to you know, take part in this and as well. And then in the same way that you hope in your consumer proposition that the Holy Grail is someone recommends you to their friend or family, what's not to think that a shareholder might say, you know, someone says, oh, I'm thinking of, you know, investing in some shares, what's your portfolio like? And they kind of go, well, I've got this, that and that. Oh, I really like this company because they keep me informed, the share price is good, the dividend is good, all these other things that are, you know, the decision maker, but actually I really like the way, you know, I feel engaged with the company, communicated to, part of it, opportunity to, you know, vote online for the AGM, see the workings of the meeting, do anything really. Mm. And I think, you know, I think that's a potential growth area for those companies with sizable lists.
So were you able to then, you know, you've got the success of the sponsorship and the Aviva Challenge site, say, look, social media works for us over here, right, now we're going to do it corporately, here's how we could do it. Was it easy to sell? Was it easy to get us put a strategy?
Oh, no. Those things are never easy to sell. I guess what one people say to me, what have you spent 10, 11 years doing?
Yeah. What have you spent?
How I often answer that is actually, you know, Aviva.com sat with me and my team. But I never ever said it was our site. I always had the, we work very closely with stakeholders from each, you know, the investor centre stakeholder, for the director and then the operational guy. And that my, our job was about consulting with them and saying, what do you want to communicate and how do you want to do it digitally and how do you want, might want to do it through Aviva.com? And then in recent years, what else would you like, where would you like to distribute that content? You know, place it on our YouTube channel, have a Twitter. So we started to think about this and you begin to look at that. And I have a great saying, you know, not a great saying, it's, you know, one I like, which is just because you can doesn't mean you should. And there is this kind of thing where in big company stuff, it goes, oh, it's up there, they've got this. And then you look at it and say, yeah, but what actually do, you know, I don't understand what the strategy, you know, is it meaningful? Why would I go back? Why would I stay tuned? Why would I have it coming into my life weekly, daily, whatever? And so we were always, as it's an insurance company that manages risk all the while, you know, we were always sometimes a bit cautious about that. So, YouTube, 2006, September, start to go well, and suddenly you think, we've got, you know, tens of thousands of views of content from people who probably would never have discovered it by coming to Aviva.com. So, you know, not bad. And how much does that cost us? Well, a little bit of that, that piece of content over there that was produced for something else, putting it on there, a bit of my time, and then da-da-da-da. So I started to look at really, you know, where you begin to understand these things that are going to have legacy, these things that come out of the pack. So you, you begin to be aware of MySpace, and then you see that kind of shift into that music-dominated thing. You kind of go, perhaps not for us. Bebo very much fixed in the kids. You know, and then you start to see, you know, LinkedIn and the beginnings of Facebook, and then obviously Twitter, and lastly Foursquare, and a number of these things. You begin to understand that. So I spent, I guess, most of 2009 talking to our media relations colleagues about the way we should start to move to have Twitter as a part of our communications mix distribution. Not because it would stand alone or replicate, but I said there was an easy way in to do this. Aviva is a powerhouse of PR, particularly in the UK, and we carry, we always used to carry, you know, as much PR as we could, news releases on the site. And because we had a mobile site, we were on the first like that, we used to generate RSS out of it. Mm-hmm. So there's a neat way that you can do with twitterfeed.com that turns your RSS into a nice little tweet. And so that will give you access into a way of saying, we can publish this here, that actually is approved content that's gone through all the approval stages in the company. That's pretty low risk. Why don't we just try it? So we talked about that, and then in January 2000, I might have lost grasp of the dates. I believe it was January 2010. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right. We got it going. And I looked at, you know, Shell.com, their Twitter feed. I looked at a number of these other Intercontinental Hotels Group and others like that, and just thinking, blimey, it's got 3,500 followers. Wow. And you start to look at the followers and you start to understand that there's other energy companies and all that, and then there's journalists, and you start to think, well, why couldn't that be for us? So we start to think about that, and then, as I said, you know, in, I guess, 14 months, we're now just hitting through the 1,000 mark. And then you look at the makeup. Who's bothering about this? Why would we do it? Well, because other people, whether it's analysts or journalists, are electing to get their news like this. They might have RSS, they might have signed up to our email drop, you know, from .com, but their behaviours are perhaps changing. Perhaps they're discovering whether it's worth to do. Absolutely. And they're then going and saying, well, what's quite interesting about that company, that, you know, they haven't got a Twitter feed, so haven't they thought about that, you know? Mm. Or actually, this is my preferred way now, I love it, you know, why don't they offer that? So you see this growth, and often in that thing, I don't know if you do it, Paul, but actually when I look at, you know, if I follow someone, I'm immediately going to see who they're following. And you're going to go, oh, that looks interesting, yeah, I'll follow them as well. Because it's about this recommendation of, if they, I quite like what he does, or she does, and you kind of go, well, if they like that stuff from them, I'll probably like that.
Yeah.
So that's how I do it. So you do that, and I think, so you see a lot of people come in through peer group. They've kind of gone somewhere else and they've found that. I'm sure they do it, and then suddenly you see this rush of you know, people signing up to follow you. And so I think that's proved very well. And so we've got an audience of 1,000. I think it's, you know, and I think, you know, the development of that for Aviva has to be, you know, the broadcast. And they're doing much more of open question stuff, pulling in other sources rather than PR-driven stuff, which is the backbone of it. It keeps it ticking over. And for those people who are signing up and saying, I prefer to get my news from you like that, very short, 140, you know, quick bit.ly email. What? Where does it take them? Aviva.com. Where therefore you hope they either get the news and part of the site, and for those busy people is to get them successfully into that site, get what they want, let them get out and get on with their job. But on those occasions when they go, I'm not so pressured or deadline driven, perhaps I'll, oh, what's else on this page? Oh, I didn't realise they had a full kind of image gallery for media use, free to use, you know, download of high res of all these people. Well, perhaps I'll have a look around and what's, I wonder what's in the CR section. And you hope that they then migrate into all the other great content that you do when they've got time. So they spend, you know, through your metrics, you see your average time on site is good. Now, that's always, you know, we have this thing, you know, in the company, average time on site, what does it actually mean? You know, in some respects, it's kind of like, if it's several minutes, it's kind of, oh, great, people are really engaging with the content. Or they're struggling to find what they want. So actually, on certain areas, not many people are spending much time here. Well, on the share price page, why? Because they like to come in, it's very visible, they get what they want and they get out. That's a measure of success. You know, in and absolutely in terms of that clarity and efficiency of doing that, that's, a, you know, sometimes a much kind of forgotten about thing, letting people get on with their business. And then this subliminal thing of them thinking, that was pretty painless and easy, didn't get like that,
I'll do it again.
So we began to do all that, and so what we then did was understood that we needed to start to manage things on LinkedIn. We have, you know, that's another big thing in terms of the PLC, the .com is a better presence on LinkedIn, and we're working with that. And the often the difficult one for everyone, which is Wikipedia, where how do you manage your presence on that in terms of that? And I started to do that very early, in terms of very clear, I would go in and only change like really factual things. So every time our customer number change or our funds under management or number of staff. And then you did that once or twice straight in, and you realise, you know, because of the nature of this, and then it's beginning to use the sandbox there, which is that thing of, hey, I'm, you know, it's only me, I'm only changing this. But keeping an eye on the content in case people are publishing in that, but actually letting that community know that you're just changing factual things to keep them up to date. So that, and then obviously this thing for big corporates, which was actually, oh, well, we've got all this sorted. What are we going to do about Facebook? Because it is becoming the place, you know, it's become the place now, you know, 650 million users around the world. It's not a fad. These astonishing statistics, you know, so 28 million users in the UK. What's that? I don't know. Just under half the population. And then within that, if you dive in within that, you know, the number of people who say, that's the first thing they do before they even get out of bed, you know, through a mobile device again. Or laptop, they check the Facebook account. So actually how this becomes part of their life. So actually what's the place of big business in that, you know, in terms of commerce or brand communication, you know, or just presence? Or and everyone going, oh, I don't know what we do there. And it's a big thing. So we were very lucky, I guess, in last year where as part of a marketing communication campaign, which went under the title You Are the Big Picture, part of the reason we were trying to connect there was with, in many respects, you know, key influencers around the globe. And the campaign was designed in such a way that it was meant to be overheard by customers, consumers, or everyday people. So we wanted to really, you know, tell people about Aviva in those key influencer communities of analysts, city journalists, C-suite, and all that and that. But also have something of participatory nature that everyday people felt, oh, I know who they are, this is what I'm good, I can join in. Mm. And then the scale of it would also then wash back into the influencer community saying, oh, Aviva have done this, that's unusual for an insurance company. And so that gave
all the buildings in our capital are coloured yellow.
And that, so then that gave us that very much that way we could get in to Facebook instead of saying, hi, we're Aviva, an insurance company, you know, come and follow us around our community, people go, perhaps not. Around a thing that talked about, a thing about getting your picture projected on a building, a moment of, you know, 15 seconds of fame, plus raise money for a charitable cause, seemed to be a really good way to enter into that and give yourself a presence. And, you know, in similar ways, you know, if you look at the success of Barclays, you know, Premiership Facebook, it gives them brand awareness and communicates who they are and what they do. But it's all about Premiership football. And similarly, RBS's Six Nation, you know, page, you know, lots of people in it because they love rugby, and RBS are a great supporter of rugby, and they can do it like that. Similarly, we were doing about that and not talking about, you know, we can sell you, oh, for all our Facebook members, you know, 10% off whatever today. That might come because I think this is where it will end up, because it's like, how do people connect? Where are they? You know, in city centres, billboards, at the cinema, watching TV, where are they congregating? And they're congregating in these spaces. So social commerce or Facebook commerce is going to be a big thing. And you've already begun to see Best Buy and ASOS, which has got a fantastic online model. You say, well, why do they need it? They understand that perhaps some of their customers or their new customers that aren't quite their customers yet.
Compare notes.
We'll do that. Recommend. But we'll also say, I'd rather do my shopping when I'm in Facebook, thank you. I don't want to have to go off to your old fuddy-duddy site. So if you can do me that, you know, that's great. And I think you begin to see this opportunity. And there's so many free tools that Facebook will give you, and then obviously entice you as a business to spend on attraction through advertising, applications and stuff like that. It's quite astonishing. It's just enormous numbers. So it's that old thing, go where your customers go. And so out of that 28 million for a company like Aviva with, you know, quite in its 53.4 million customers around the world, quite a sizable number in the UK, again, it's not too much of a stretch to work out many of them will be on Facebook. So thinking about, right, are we ready to have, say, an e-commerce motor and household page? Perhaps Aviva is not that, and many insurers might not be ready for that, but actually thinking about, well, where should we be in 3 years with this? You know, if we're seeing this growth, and Facebook, you know, and pretty definite they want a billion subscribers within perhaps another 2 years, and given their current rate of progress, would you bet against it? No. And with these kind of things that we've just seen launched this week with Facebook Deals in the US, which is you know, their big Groupon killer, you know, and I belong to a number of these, you know, Groupon, Living Social, and we've got a great one, actually, talking about how it can work for communities. There's one, you know, strange name, it's called Tickles, but it serves Norwich and Norfolk. There's some great deals that come through that, and it's, you know, part-owned by the old newspaper I used to work for. And it's about, you know, fundamental great deals and connection. And I think with Facebook, you understand that it's become part of people's lives. My daughter certainly is on it a lot. She feels connected, not only with her close group of friends, but friends that live away, overseas, friends that live other part of the country that we've met, and, you know, they've moved there or whatever. And she definitely is feeling, you know, that's the way that her almost, this the other thing that's talked about is I asked her, you know, and a great article about it, you know, when do these 13-year-olds, do you use email? Pardon? Nigga? Email? Is that for something more formal? And it's about, no, it's about MSN, Facebook, messaging, you know. It's almost like the digitization of your life. Even as someone who grew up, and, I, you know, before we were kind of talking about my life in newspapers, where I, you know, when I was a journalist, you have to battle the other journalists to get the good typewriter in the newsroom with the, you know, good carbons, top copy for the subs bench, bottom copy for the news desk. And this growth of technology that makes everything very, very much easier. In my life, I've now understood that my life is digitised. I can't remember the last time I wrote a longhand letter. I do it on the, you know, templated on the computer. I collect my photographs on there. I have virtually all my music collection digitised through iTunes. I'm increasingly putting my home movies, and products like Apple's iMovie gives you a free thing thrown in that you can make a nice little, you can have a go. And this great feature now where you can make Hollywood trailers out of it, you know, that last about 90 seconds. They're joyous. simple things that you think, I'll have a go at that. But you end up with a result, you kind of surprise yourself. And I think there's lots of these tools around. And I think, you know, it's just like Facebook is the one that's driving it. So Foursquare, again, you know, you look at Facebook Places. Will that eventually do for Foursquare? Great model. Twitter, you know, I think the thing with Twitter is actually you can understand where Facebook is going in terms of actually monetizing, earning money. Because big companies will go, how many people are on there every day? Oh, we'd like to advertise on there, thank you. Twitter, growth are not so that, but actually it's that thing that lots of opinion forums are commenting on, you know, how is it going to make money? Well, it certainly seems to be growing. It might not do it as quickly as Facebook, but I think, you know, for those people at Twitter, they, you know, that's the next big thing, you know. How do you sell, you know, how do you make it pay?
But if you've got networks of recommenders and followers.
Absolutely.
That's...
And the other thing is absolutely this freeing this more commercialization, which Facebook would do, which is actually we're all about community. I mean, we don't want big business in here. And the users say, no, we don't want big business. You know, these surveys just said, what about if someone tried to sell you something in Facebook? No, thank you. Don't want any of that. But understand people saying, well, no, actually, if it's all right and I elect to sign up to it,
It's
not intrusive, but I make the choice.
And I get a good deal.
And it's rewarding. Yeah, I don't mind a bit of that. And I think you'll see this, and I think, you know, that's where Facebook are talking to big companies to say, how can we help you reach these people in a meaningful way? And I think that's what Twitter's, you know, need to do that, really, in terms of, you know, talking to big business that would put some big bucks into it in terms of reaching them. As opposed to, well, we've got our own Twitter feed. Well, yeah, we get that's a free, isn't it? We gave you that. You just need to have someone on that running it. What you're doing to reach out and collect or communicate those things. So, yeah, and then it's the next, what's happening next, really. And I think there's probably, and there's two or three things that are happening, these very interesting things that come out that you just don't know, I talked about earlier. And there's one called Chroma Roma, I don't know if you've seen that. That's a new game about, if you, and it's, it sounds quite parochial, but if you travel on the London transport system, you can connect with your Oyster card, and you play a game. So if you're travelling a lot like this, it's a bit of fun at the moment. You're thinking it's location-based, it's using data, it's understanding, it's elective, so you do it or not. And when people are spending a lot of time, it's kind of like they're leaderboards and stuff like that. And the other one, which is a really interesting thing, which I've just signed up for, is Empire Avenue, which is a US-based site which actually... you trade in social media personalities and leaders in terms of their spheres of influence. And you can buy shares and you can earn stuff by how many followers you've got on Twitter, how often you tweet, how your connections are. Really interesting model. And you can't, my feeling about this is I sign up for it and I take part and I go, I don't know if A, am I interested to sustain this? B, have I got enough time really to do this? C, is this just a flash in the pan and, you know, do all this, then it's going to disappear. But there's one or two people who I respect and follow on Twitter, you know, Jeremiah O. Yuang, the webstrategist.com. He's particularly, you know, he works at Altimeter and he's particularly bigging it up at the moment. And I kind of think, you know, when people like that start to form opinions, you know, who am I not to kind of like just like listen and take it all in? So I've signed up for that. And I think that's the other thing about, you know, never be afraid to try things out. A little personal account to understand how these things work. And then through that almost the osmosis of understanding what would that mean for the company that I work for, or if you're in an agency, the company that we're trying to do business with in terms of guide or strategize with, or often as I've described it, I like, kind of way I like these agencies to do it, is to come along and poke you with a sharp stick and kind of go, why don't you do that? Have you seen what they're up to? You could do that. And you kind of think, yeah, we could, or that's not our priority, but that's a good idea, or no, that's not right for us. But this constant debate across the fence of actually best practice and, you know, and what you need to do to keep the agenda moving forward, you know, or finding simpler, better ways of connecting and communicating.
I think we're probably at the end of our time, so I think we'll end it there. So maybe do a second episode at some other time. So thank you very much, Mr. Stuart Bartram. Thank you for the thoughts.
thank you, Paul. And I really enjoyed it. I'm very much enjoyed the ones you've done so far. It's the kind of stuff that fires me up, that gets me thinking, that just, you know, deposits, when I hear people talk, that I like and respect, and there's things that plant seeds in your brain, and you might not be able to deal with them immediately, but you kind of bring them out of the old filing cabinet a couple of months later and think, yeah, perhaps I understand that more now, and perhaps we could do something like that, or we should really consider, you know, what they're talking about there. So thank you.